Okay, so I'm going to do something which could easily confuse all of us today. And it's not my goal. So if something isn't clear, then, you know, by all means, let me know. Because, as I said, it's not my goal to confuse. I just know that it could be. Because I'm making an assumption, and the assumption is like this absolutely terrible assumption. And that is that you actually know the entire book of Shemot. And for that matter, like I make an assumption, you know everything in Chumash. And I know I'm not supposed to do that. But there are enough things that you do know that what I'm going to do today is going to make sense, but it's going to be hard to like get the whole thing. And I understand that. But essentially what I want to do today is I want to introduce a concept which I think you're familiar with. And that is the way that I could say it in English, I could say it in Hebrew, and it won't sound like the same thing at all. Yeah, so I'm going to start in English. And that is, the question exists if the Torah has chronological integrity. Okay, so that's the issue, chronological integrity. The way that they would say this in Hebrew would be either Ein mukdam u'mochar l'Torah, or Yesh mukdam u'mochar l'Torah, which means when you say Ein mukdam u'mochar l'Torah, then essentially what you're saying is that in the Torah there's no chronological integrity. Mukdam means first, mu'uchar means after. So when you say Ein mukdam u'mochar l'Torah, in a sense what you're saying is that the Torah doesn't necessarily follow the chronology of the events that take place. Now, some of you were in my class in Agadah in the very beginning of the year, in the first semester, in the first class, when you were probably trying to figure out why I was wasting your time talking about Bob Dylan and talking about his, not even his songs initially, but his teacher for painting, because that was really one of the issues involved, was how do you deal with time? Which means let me start all over again, and I want to say it in a much simpler way right now. When we tell stories, any of us, when we tell stories, we are almost never concerned with absolute chronology of the events as they took place. And in fact, the opposite is true. Sometimes you have to work really hard and think exactly what happened first. But very often you're going to get home at the end of the year and you're going to tell your friend about the friend that you met over here and like six different things that happened. You're not going to be able to tell all those stories necessarily exactly in the order or the sequence that they took place, because that's simply not how our brain works. Our brains work more by connecting things with other things that are similar to them, or the way to put it differently would be our brains work on a thematic level much more than in a chronological level. So if you're going to talk about good times that you had with your younger sister and how you made trouble and how you got into trouble, you're not necessarily going to go through day by day, week by week, year by year in the proper sequence. You're going to tell one story after the other, but those stories each one will trigger another story in your mind. So now that's the way that we talk, and that's the way that we tell stories. So what I think is more intriguing, so what exactly does the Torah do? So there is first of all, to make this easier, I'll say it in absolute terms. The Torah does not always follow the proper sequence historically. That everybody has to agree. It could be at some point in your education, maybe somebody once said to you, oh, the Ramban says this, and the Ibn Ezra says this, or Rashi says this. What the whole argument that people will normally speak about is an argument when there is no 100% clear evidence in the Torah. So, for example, in the book of Bamidbar, it starts off the book in the second year in the second month. And it says it. And it happened in the second year in the second month. And then a couple chapters later it says, and it happened in the second year in the first month. So there is no way in the world to deal with this other than to say the Torah chose to tell a story that happened later first and a story that happened first later. So I'm saying there everybody, including the Ramban, says there that Ein Mukdam U'Mochar L'Torah. The question is this one of the tools in the arsenal of a biblical commentator to solve a problem which they see and say, oh, this happened after this, or this happened before that? Now, what we're really going to talk about today is Matan Torah, which we spoke about last week, and that's going to be part of the problem. is, and let me just explain it a little bit clearer even. Most of us, when we were young and indoctrinated into the world of Torah, and I don't use the word indoctrinated in a bad way, but when we were indoctrinated, we were indoctrinated into a Rashi-centric world, which means what Rashi said goes. What Rashi says is true. Rashi is our friend, and Rashi is our commentator, and Rashi is the one who's teaching us what exactly it is or how exactly we're supposed to understand the Torah. So we are in a Rashi world. So because we're in a Rashi world, there are certain things in our heads that we remember. Here's something which, again, I think personally is really interesting. You may not find it as interesting as me, but this past Shabbat, a Haredi fellow, and I'm sorry for pointing out Haredi, because you would think, you know, long coat. He comes, the last couple of weeks we've been shut down, so the shul isn't really open, so I don't go to shul, but shul comes to me. That's one of the advantages of being a rabbi. So people come in front of my house and we dive in there. So this fellow comes, and he says to me, where does the Torah talk about the golden calf? Because I couldn't find it. Now, that should be a remarkable statement. I couldn't find it. Now, I know why he couldn't find it. It's very sad. Why couldn't he find it? Because he knows that right after the Ten Commandments, Moshe goes up, and that's where the golden calf is. Now, there's a problem. Because I'm again making this terrible assumption that you know all, I told you, that you know all of Shemot right now. So the introduction to the Aseret HaDibrot was last week, Yitro, chapter 19. The Aseret HaDibrot was said, chapter 20. Then we go into this week's parasha, Mishpatim, and we have 21, 22, 23. All of those chapters talk about Mishpatim. They talk about laws. They go into all kinds of details. Man-to-man laws, interpersonal laws. Man-to-man is probably not politically correct, right? Interpersonal laws. We go to laws between man and God. All kinds of laws are being mentioned. And then we get to chapter 24, and it comes back and it speaks about receiving the Torah. So you know this whole thing about Na'aseh v'nishma, that we said Na'aseh v'nishma, and you know the whole thing that the Gemara says, and the angels start to make fun of us and tell us that we're an impetuous people? The Gemara say, what kind of Jews? What's the matter with you? God offers you the Torah, so you say Na'aseh v'nishma, which is understood in that Gemara, is we will do whatever you tell. Now tell us what it is. I think all of you understand that that's not the way to sign a contract. The way you sign a contract is somebody says, you know, can you do something for me? If I were to ask any of you, can you do me a favor? Would you just say yes? You wouldn't even ask what it is? So there's a level of trust there. So then that's very good. Or you'd say yes? That's crazy. You're out of your minds, all of you. So, yeah, because sometimes you want to, doesn't mean that you can, doesn't mean, whatever, life is complicated. So when God says, you know, about accepting the Torah, so the Jews say, yeah, Na'aseh v'nishma, we'll do it, and then they'll tell us what it is. And in the Gemara, that sounds so impressive. It sounds so impressive because, you know, look, again, the angels make fun of us, look how impetuous you are, and God says, you know, this is great, you know, this is like this wonderful thing that the Jews are able to do that. Now, Rashi loves that, I'll call it Midrash, Agadah, teaching, idea, concept. He loves that. How do I know that he loves that? Because of the, and that's what we're going to get to today, the amount that he had to twist things to make that work. Which means, as great as that sounds, it's not necessarily as simple as I'm presenting it. So let me just try to spell things out again a little bit better. So this week is Mishpatim, I told you, three chapters of laws, and then one chapter which goes back to the Aseret, goes back to the idea of receiving the Torah. At the very, very end, Moshe goes up for 40 days and 40 nights. What's next week? Next week is Truma, and then Tetzaveh, and then Kitisa. So Truma and Tetzaveh are complete instructions on how to build a Mishkan, and then instructions about the various clothing of the Kohen Gadol, and so on and so forth. And then we get to Kitisa, and about collecting money, and so on. And finally, then we get to the sin of the golden calf. It's in chapter 32. So we went, and chapter 32 is when Moshe comes down with the Luchot, but the people are making a golden calf. So he's looking for it immediately after the Aseret HaDibrot, and therefore he couldn't find it. So I'm going to say again, it's really sad that's what he's doing, but I'm not even sure if he remembered that the story of the Ten Commandments gets divided between chapters 19-20 and then chapter 24, which itself is really quite intriguing. Now, regarding every single thing that I've said so far, Rashi will come and say, oh, by the way, these things are not in the proper sequence. So I'll start with the easier one, probably the more famous one. When we finish chapter 31, and the last thing said there is then God gives Moshe the Luchot to come down, right? The Luchot are completed, and then the Jews start making the golden calf. Right before that, Rashi writes, oh, by the way, the sin of the golden calf happened before chapter 25, before Truman Tetzaveh, before God started giving us all the instructions to build the Mishkan. So Rashi, therefore, is saying the idea of building the Mishkan is filled in over here. Of course, all of us should be asking us a question. So if the sequence or the chronology is not the way the Torah presents it, why does the Torah present things outside of the chronology? That event, that ultimately is going to become our problem. But I'll say this again. That's just a really explicit way, which means essentially Rashi is saying that chapter 32 comes before chapter 25. But I'll say it again. The problem is actually more profound. Because, for example, in the beginning of last week's parsha, Yitro shows up. Yitro shows up. The first thing they do is they make a party. They say L'chaim. He says Baruch Hashem and so on. And then it says, and on the next day, right, Lehi L'macharat, on the next day, Yitro's watching how Moshe's working too hard, and Moshe needs to delegate. Yes, we all need to delegate. He sees that Moshe is taking everything upon himself. He says, you can't do that. You need to really to be able to delegate. But Rashi there says Moshe's sitting all day, day to night, judging the people. So now here comes a question. See, one of the things we always need to do when considering Rashi is always to ask ourselves a question. What problem is Rashi coming to answer? I learned how to read Rashi with probably the greatest expert in the world on reading Rashi. Her name was Nechama Leibowitz. Okay? So I learned with her how to read Rashi, and that is absolutely what she would do every single time. And by the way, if you just read her books, or you just heard, maybe I hope you heard of her, but if you just read her books, or, she was like a third grade teacher. In the sense that she was demanding, and she would be asking, and she would make you answer the question and make everybody do homework and so on. And she would, every Rashi she would start to read, what problem is Rashi coming to solve, right? What is he coming to answer? So Rashi there says that Moshe is judging the people day to night, and Rashi then says, first I'll tell you what he says, and then we'll have to figure out what he's coming to answer. Rashi then says, oh, Yehi L'macharat, the day afterwards, the next day, is really the day after Yom Kippur. So, first let me explain to you how amazing that statement is, and then we'll have to figure out what he's trying to answer. The day after Yom Kippur, so hold it a second. The Jews left Egypt in the springtime, which holiday on Pesach? What day is this? So they leave on the 15th day of Nisan. Approximately 50 days later, or a little bit before that, on Rosh Chodesh, this is the very beginning of chapter 19, by the way, on Rosh Chodesh, the Jews arrive at Mount Sinai. So when did Yitro come? So did Yitro come before they arrived at Mount Sinai? Did it come after they arrived at Mount Sinai? Our impression is it's already after Sinai, but let's hold on for that a second. The Jews leave Egypt, they travel, Rosh Chodesh, Sivan, they arrive at Mount Sinai, and it says it. Then a couple of days go by, and there's like this whole back and forth, which is told in chapter 19 and maybe chapter 24. Then Moshe goes up for 40 days and 40 nights. By the way, this should be very easy then, because then we're more or less, give or take, 40 days plus 50 days is 90 days, which means that by the time Moshe comes down, we're ballpark, how much? 40 and 50, 90 around, more or less. 3 months, right? So that means Nisan, Iyan, Sivan, right? Tammuz. And that's what tradition says, it was the 17th day of Tammuz when Moshe comes down. Then the people are sinning. And Moshe has to pray for them, and God punishes them. And Moshe is invited up to receive the second Luchot on Rosh Chodesh Elul. By the way, if you've ever wondered why the 40 days from Elul till Yom Kippur are days of Slichot, and days of Tshuva, and days where introspection, especially Rosh Hashanah through Yom Kippur, Moshe comes down with the second Luchot on Yom Kippur. And that's the first Yom Kippur. We don't even know it's called Yom Kippur. But why is it Yom Kippur? Because that's the day the Jews are actually forgiven. So that's why it's Yom Kippur. The day the Jews are forgiven for the golden calf is Yom Kippur. What's interesting then is God says the next year, oh, you know what? Every year you should still celebrate Yom Kippur or commemorate it, because the forgiving aspects of this day will last forever, and therefore every Yom Kippur are days that we ask God for forgiveness. So therefore, we just now worked really hard, and we got all the way up to Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur of year number one after leaving Egypt. So we're like a half a year later or so, right? And Rashi just now told us that the day that Yitro was watching is the day after Yom Kippur. Now, what made him say that? Well, and by the way, just to put numbers on all of this, that means that Rashi just now told me events of chapter 18 took place prior, or the same day even, as the events of chapter 35. So now you realize, hopefully, when I talked about chronological integrity, Rashi got into our heads, because that's what we know. So therefore, when you're learning the book of Shemot, unless you know where something is, you have no chance of finding it, because nothing's really there where you think it is, because in our heads, everything is in another place. And that's why I don't blame the guy. Hold it, I can't find the golden calf, because it's not where you would think it is. So far, what I've pointed out now about is chapters 18, chapter 35. There's also a problem. Rashi is going to tell us that the events of chapter 19 and chapter 24 are the same days. Chapter 19 and 24, exact same days. Same events being told. Why are they being told twice? Being told, slightly different perspective, same day, 19 and 24. What else did Rashi say? That chapter 25 through 31 take place after chapter 32. So now, again, you know, so what did Rashi just now do to us? You want another example? Go back to also in Parshat Bishalach. It says there that the month started to fall, and then it says, as an aside, and it fell for 40 years. And then it says that God that tells Moshe tells Aaron to take some of it and put it in a time capsule and put it in front of God. That phrase, in front of God, has the implication of put it in the Mishkan. In front of God, put it in the Mishkan. There is no Mishkan back in chapter 15. Which means chapter 15 is talking about doing something and placing it in a Mishkan, which is not going to be complete until the very end of the book of Shemot, which is all the way by chapter 40. Are we confused, or is everything clear now? I don't know. That's what I'm saying. I don't know if I'm going to confuse you today or make sense out of all of this. You want to get worse? Here's another example. What day was the Mishkan completed? Answer, Rosh Chodesh Nisan, year 2. Rosh Chodesh Nisan, year 1, is chapter 12 in Shemot, HaChodesh HaZelechem. Chapter 40 is the day that it's completed, and we're told that it's completed on the first day of Nisan, year number 2. So that means, year number 2, Mishkan completed, in Sefer Shemot, real time, chapter 40, that's the very end of the book, it's completed. In the middle of Vayikra, we get up to the sin of Nadav and Avihu, and there Rashi tells us that what Vayehi b'Yom HaShmini, and Rashi says, oh, it's Yom HaShmini of all the preparations of the Mishkan, but it's actually Rosh Chodesh Nisan, which means by Parshat Shmini, he says, oh, by the way, it's the same day as the end of the book of Shemot. If that's not good enough for you, you go all the way to Bamidbar, Parshat Naso, where the 12 Nisiim are bringing their offerings for the consecration of the Mishkan, and the first day, the first one on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, is Nachshon ben Aminadav, and there also Rashi says, oh, by the way, that's Rosh Chodesh Nisan, which means I just now pointed out real time the same. This is the longest day. Anybody ever ask what's the longest day in Chumash? The longest day in Chumash is Rosh Chodesh Nisan, which it stretches from Parshat Shemot into Sefer Shemot. Parsha Pekudei, Sefer Vayikra, Parsha Shmini, Sefer Bamidbar, Parsha Naso, it's all the same day. So then now, when your heads, you can't figure out the order or the sequence of things, so now you know why, because how are you supposed to remember this? But the issue at hand, as I said, in Parshat Mishpatim, this issue is going to come up again. But first I want to go back and teach you the Ramban. The Ramban is the one who will say, you cannot say things are out of order unless the Torah told you things are out of order. So therefore the Ramban would admit that in Sefer Bamidbar, where year one, month two comes before, sorry, year two, month two is written before year two, month one. There the Ramban would say, okay, the Torah chose not to tell this in its proper sequence. The Ramban, as far as I'm concerned, would have to admit when it says the Jews ate the man for 40 years, that God told Moshe this at the end of the 40 years and told him to write it over here. And by the way, that's another example of a thematic connection as opposed to a chronological connection. Once we're talking about the Jews eating man, okay, they did it for 40 years. Once we're talking about the man, also they told the time capsule story. But that you have to, again, I'm saying you have to. I think you have to then admit that's coming and saying at a later time. Now, I'm going to say it again. Why am I doing all of this? I'm doing all of this because of something which I already told you, and that was because of Naaseh V'Nishma. So according to Rashi, well, let me just go back to the Ramban for a second. If you ever want to know what the Ramban thinks about Sefer Shemot, for example, here's the secret. Don't tell anybody the secret. The secret is that every single thing happens in the order that it's written. There you go. Which means you actually have to detox from your Rashi-centric world, get Rashi out of your head, and just read the Chumash in the proper sequence, and now you'll know every single Ramban, at least that deals with chronology, in the book of Shemot, because you just say, oh, every single thing is the order that it's written in. That's all, that's the answer. And by the way, this isn't easy. When I was probably around 19 years old, maybe 19, maybe 20, I decided that I needed to detox, and I decided that I'm just going to read the Chumash by itself. I mean, every year I try to read the Chumash with some kind of a commentary, and I change off from year to year. But that year I decided to, I'm going to read, I mean, before that I had learned Rashi. Before that I learned the Ramban. And before I said, hold it a second, I just need to get my head clear and get Rashi out of my head right now. And then afterwards, after I did this, then I went back and learned Rashi again, because it was only then that I can even understand Rashi, because beforehand I was just too influenced by Rashi. I hope that made some sense. When you're too influenced by Rashi, then you don't understand it. You only understand it when you actually know what the text really says. So what made Rashi say that this was the day after Yom Kippur? So what made Rashi understand that Yitro's coming in chapter 18 happens after chapter 34? What made him, or chapter 35, what made him say this? Because Moshe's sitting and judging the people from day to night. Based on what is he judging the people? Presumably, he's judging the people based on the Torah. But when did Moshe have an opportunity to teach the people Torah and to judge them based on Torah? So the first opportunity that Rashi is saying he would have had was after Yom Kippur, because before that, they had done the golden calf. Before that, Moshe busy praying for them. Moshe only comes down from the mountain the second time on Yom Kippur. So it can only be after Yom Kippur that Moshe could be sitting and judging the people based on what's written in the Torah. Now, by the way, that is not the only solution. It's not like if the Ramban and Rashi were sitting here, they never met. There was more than 100 years between them. If Rashi and the Ramban were sitting here and Rashi would say, well, it has to be, the Ramban would say, well, no, it really doesn't have to be. For example, the Ramban can say, don't you remember that we were told a little bit earlier back in Parsha B'Shalach, where it says that Sham Sam L'Chokul Mishpat, that here Moshe gave them some chukim and some mishpatim. He taught them some laws at this point. Afterwards, when the month falls for 6 days and fall on the seventh, Moshe says, but that's what I told you about Shabbat, which means they do know some things. So he could have argued that Moshe is judging based upon the laws that they already know. There's actually a great commentary of the Chizkuni. If you've never heard of the Chizkuni, he is from this larger school that we would call Tosfot sometimes. And he says something, he doesn't like it. Just because he doesn't like it, I'm allowed to like what he doesn't like. But he quoted it. He says, you know who Moshe was judging? He was judging the Eir of Rav, those, how do you call the Eir of Rav? The riffraff. Those who joined the Jewish people and came out. He was judging them who were suing the Jews. Why were they suing the Jews? It says that they were among the people that lent their gold and silver and clothing to the Jews before they left. They lent them all these things. And then some of them came and left with the Jews. And then they're suing. They say, hold it, we want our stuff back. So he says that's what Moshe was sitting and judging them about. But the Chizkuni, as I said, he mentions that. Some people say that, but he doesn't like it. I thought it was very, very cute, which means my point is I don't have to accept Rashi's idea that Yitro first comes only after chapter 30 and everything. But again, I have to ask, hold it. Why is it written in this sequence? By the way, that's a better question and deserves more attention than I'm giving it right now. If Yitro, according to Rashi, doesn't happen until after Yom Kippur, which means until after chapter 30, in middle chapter 35, then why in the world is Rashi telling it to us now? I'll give you an answer to that question. I'm not going to say this is what Rashi said, but I will say this is what I'm getting out of Rashi. What happened immediately before Yitro came? There was something happened right before then. Answer is, Yitro hears all the things that happened to the Jews. There's a whole argument in the Gemara what he heard. Some say that he heard that the Jews got out. Some say that he heard about the war against Amalek. I want to come back to that. And some say that he heard Matan Torah. So according to the opinion that says they heard Matan Torah, so it's a no-brainer. So that means that it's not in the right order. That's it. You can't do anything about it. It's not in the right order because Matan Torah is not till afterwards. But if he heard any of those other things, Jews getting out of Egypt or about the war against Amalek or the splitting of the sea or whatever, but the sequence here is interesting to me the way that it's presented. You have Amalek, and then you have Yitro. Both of them are not Jewish. So here is now a teaching that I would then say, based on this, I'm not going to force this into Rashi's mouth, but I would say this is where Rashi got me to think. There is a midrash that says, and this is a midrash, it's a teaching, and I'm not meant to be taken literally. I'm sorry if I have to say these things, but sometimes you have to say it. It's not meant to be taken literally. It says, Paro has three advisors. One advisor was a man named Bilam. Bilam said, and Paro says, what do I do with the Jews, okay? What do I do with my Jewish problem? And Bilam says, well, to the Jewish problem, you need a final solution. And that is, kill all of them. Bilam, Bili'am, Bala'am, swallow up a nation, genocide, kill everybody. That's what Bilam, and so later on, Bilam tries to curse the Jews. Because for him, as far as he's concerned, genocide is a good thing. So what did the Midrash do? It took this negative character, stuck him into Paro's court as one of his advisors. So, genocide. Second advisor was a man named Eov, Job. What does Eov say? Eov doesn't say anything because that's part of Eov. That's part of the whole thing. He never speaks, where he doesn't complain. Eov is silent. Okay, but hold on to that for a second. The third advisor, according to this Midrash, was Yitro. And Yitro says it's unethical to kill people. You know, self-defense is one thing, but killing people is something which is unethical, and therefore he gets chased away, he gets fired as an advisor, and Bilam ends up making a lot of money as an advisor. And what is the purpose of this midrash? So again, I'm telling you what I think, but I will also admit to you that I am heavily influenced by my teacher on this time not Nachama Leibowitz, somebody else named Rabbi Soloveitchik, very influenced on this. And this is not something I heard from him, but this is something that I read that he wrote. And he said as follows. Well, I'm going to interpret a little bit. I'll tell you what he said about Eov, but I'm going to... Are non-Jews good or bad? So I want you to all tell me that that's a terrible question. Okay? You have to tell me that. That's a terrible question to ask. What do you know, they good or bad? There's some good Jews, some bad Jews. There's some good non-Jews, there's some bad non-Jews. By the way, the reason why it's more complicated is because sometimes the non-Jews that love us are the ones that we have to be the most afraid of. That's why it's more complicated. Because sometimes the one that likes us the most are the ones who wants to save our souls for us. And the ones who want to convert us, or the ones who want to marry us, or the ones who want to do all kinds of things. Which I'm saying is that it's just a little more complicated, and it's not that I'm completely cynical. It's sometimes the non-Jews that hate us are the ones that we know exactly where we stand. But let me go back again. What is this Midrash telling you? It's telling you, as far as non-Jews go, that there are at least three types or three prototypes. One type is like Bilam, who the anti-Semite who wants to kill us. One type, well, again, I'm skipping Eo for a second. One type is Yitro, who loves us. And Yitro, you know, wants the best for us. And that's what's really interesting, is you have the Amalek story, and then you have the Yitro story. Amalek hears we got out of Egypt, and they come, and they're attempting genocide. They want to kill us all. Yitro hears the story of us getting out of Egypt. He wants to come and celebrate and say Baruch Hashem, which means it could be that according to Rashi's understanding, you move the story of Yitro right after the story of Amalek to teach us all a lesson. Don't look at Amalek and therefore draw conclusions on all non-Jews want to kill us. Don't be paranoid. Don't think that way. There are terrible non-Jews and there are wonderful non-Jews. But so do you all see what I did right now? I'm not telling you that Rashi said it. But what I just said is that that's what I'm getting out of Rashi, because I still have to answer the question according to Rashi. If this story of Yitro doesn't take place until after Matan Torah, because he only hears about Matan Torah, according to at least that opinion, and for that matter, Rashi says that he's only judging them after Yom Kippur, that's way down the line by chapter 35, why put it here? So then it becomes a foil. You have this terrible Amalek, you have this wonderful Yitro. Don't be superficial. Don't say all non-Jews are, because that's a superficial, wrong approach. But I have to get back to Eov. We skipped Eov. Eov was silent. Why was he silent? Because Eov said, I want to keep neutrality. I don't want to take sides. So essentially, Eov is like Switzerland during World War II. But this was Rabbi Soloveitchik's point, that neutrality in the face of Nazism and saying you don't want to take sides is in itself evil. Not to speak up against something which is evil is not stopping evil. And therefore, Eov, if you know the book, one of the problems with Eov, he's a good person, he's a nice person. But Eov, again, he doesn't do bad, but he also doesn't do good. That's part of his neutrality. No, I'm just, you know, he thinks that by not doing bad, you're good. One second, do you all get that? By not doing bad, you're good. That's not true. Because sometimes by not doing bad, you're not doing something which is good. A matter of fact, by not doing bad, but letting bad exist right in front of you, is something which is evil. Which means that Eov is a person who doesn't feel somebody else's pain. So what does God do to Eov? He gives him his own pain. Which means the Midrash is explaining, why does Eov deserve to suffer if he's a person who doesn't do bad? And the answer is because he also doesn't do good. And therefore, Switzerland, facing the Nazis during World War II, says, listen, we're not taking sides over here. What do you mean you're not taking sides? You're not taking sides in the face of something which is pure evil and trying to commit genocide? Here you're not taking sides? You prefer neutrality? Well, excuse me, sometimes neutrality can be absolutely evil when the side that you're not willing to fight against is a side which is evil. Is this all clear? Do you like the way that I just now teased that out of Rashi, even though Rashi didn't say that? But the only reason I was able to do that is because it's not just that, okay, Rashi said this happened then, next. No, you can't do that. Rashi's saying this is not in its right place. Now you have to break your head and figure out if it's not in its right place, then why is the world being told in the way that it's being told? And now you have to start working all over again. But what was the main point that I wanted to get to today? I told you, the main point that I wanted to get to was Na'aseh V'Nishma. So, remember our, we'll call it romantic. Our romantic Na'aseh V'Nishma is one where, just to make sure this is recording when I shut it, so I don't drain all my batteries. I'm not convinced. Okay. So, according to Rashi, the Na'aseh V'Nishma is romantic. We're all for the Torah, Na'aseh V'Nishma. Whatever it says, we're going to do. Total leap of faith. It's wonderful. But there is a problem. The first problem which exists is actually reading the pasuk, reading the rest of the verse that contains the Na'aseh V'Nishma in it. So let me try to read you that verse. And then we're going to have to go back to the Rashi and so on and so forth. Okay. Now, according to Rashi, all of chapter 24 happens the same days as chapter 19. The second, the third, the fourth, and the fifth days of Sivan leading up to Matan Torah. So, according to Rashi, this verse, El Moshe Amar, Alei El Hashem, right, go up, you know, he'll say this is before Matan Torah. Rashi writes, this is before Matan Torah, which means chapter 24 just took us back to chapter 19. So, Vayavo Moshe v'saper la'am, it's called Devarei Hashem, v'it's called Mishpatim. And he told them all of the things that God said and all the Mishpatim. Now that word, all of the Mishpatim, all the laws, is going to be part of my problem, part of our problem. But hold on to that for a second. He told them all the Mishpatim. Vayan kol ha'am, kol achad v'yomru. And all the people said, kol adrim ha'she diber Hashem na'aseh. Whatever God said, we're going to do. But they said na'aseh after Moshe told them what God had just now said in the Mishpatim. This is 24. Okay. Then it continues, and it says they bring korbanot and so on, and they sprinkle blood, this and that. We'll skip all the bloody parts for you. V'yikach sefer habrit. And then Moshe takes the book of the Brit. What is the book of the Brit? The book of the covenant. V'yikra ba'uznei ha'am. And he read it to the people. V'yomru, and the people said, kol asher diber Hashem, everything that God said, na'aseh v'nishma. Hold it. Did I just now ruin already na'aseh v'nishma for you? What did it just now say? That first of all, he read to them the Mishpatim. What did it say afterwards? It said that he read them the Sefer HaBrit. So we do have to figure out what the Sefer HaBrit is. And then the people heard this, and the people said that whatever was said, whatever God said, we're going to do, right? I just want to read the words again. V'yikach Sefer HaBrit, he takes the Book of the Covenant, v'yikra bo'znei ha'am, and he reads in the ears of the people, v'yomru, they said, kol asher diber Hashem, na'aseh v'nishma. Everything that God said, na'aseh, we will do, v'nishma, we will hear. But they just now heard the Sefer HaBrit. They just now heard all the Mishpatim. So Rashi is making believe that all of this happened before Matan Torah. So for Rashi, it's incredibly romantic and it's wonderful. So can I tell you now what the Ramban does with all this? I already told you the Ramban. What's the secret of the Ramban? How do you remember the Ramban? Everything is the order that it said. Which means the people... Okay, so let's understand what's about to happen. At the end of this chapter, Moshe is going to go off for 40 days and 40 nights. The question is, what exactly transpires between the beginning of what we call Matan Torah to the end of Matan Torah. So the Ramban, once again, it is very simple because it's just what it said. The only thing complicated about the Ramban is that it's not in our heads because it's not the way that we were taught, because we were taught Rashi. So what does the Ramban say happened? Chapter 19, they prepare for Matan Torah. They separate from the men and the women separate. It's not separate seating as far as separating to get to a level of purity to be ready for Matan Torah. The Torah, then God says the Ten Commandments. Then something else happens. The people then say, stop speaking. Now, according to the Ramban, they heard all Ten Commandments. Why? Because they only say stop after God says all ten. So they all heard all Ten Commandments. So this Rashi world, again, that most of us know, they only heard the first two. And the reason that we distinguish between the first two and the other eight is actually a linguistic oddity in how the first two are phrased versus the last eight. And the Ramban points that out as well. He says, that's what got Chazal to make this point. So according to the Ramban, they heard all ten. Then God was going to explain to them all of the details more directly. Which details? Answer, according to the Ramban, Parshat Mishpatim. If you want homework, I'm willing to give it to you. Take the Ten Commandments, put them into 10 categories, take all of Parshat Mishpatim, each verse, and tell me which one of those 10 commandments they fit into, and you'll find you will not have to work very hard, and you can take all of Parshat Mishpatim and fit them into those 10 categories. Essentially, what happens, God is going to explain to the people the expansion of the laws. The 10 commandments are chapter headings. They're not specific laws, they're chapters. And therefore, Parshat Mishpatim, chapter 21 and 22 and 23, all of them are explanations of the Aseret HaDibrot. So people ask Moshe, can you get this from God? So Moshe says, fine. Moshe then learns with God all of Parshat Mishpatim. Now, what did it just now say? He comes back to the people. He tells them the Mishpatim. He reads them the Sefer HaBrit. We still have to understand what the Sefer HaBrit is, which means, according to the Ramban, I would easily say he wrote down all of these things till this point. And the people say, Na'aseh v'nishma. But what's the Na'aseh v'nishma? It's after they heard the Aseret HaDibrot and after they heard all of Parshat Mishpatim. So what did I just now do? I totally ruined the romantic Na'aseh v'nishma. They already heard all of the details. They said Na'aseh v'nishma after they heard Sefer HaBrit, and that's what it says. Now Rashi's going to have to explain what the Sefer HaBrit is. So Rashi's going to say, oh, the Sefer HaBrit, that's Bereshit. Sefer HaBrit is a narrative. It's the stories. They heard about the stories about Avram and Sarah, and heard about the stories about Yitzchak and Rivka and so on. They said, yeah, Naseh v'Nishma, they liked the stories. No, the Naseh v'Nishma, Rashi's actually cutting the verse in half. They heard all the stories. That's great. We love our biblical stories. And Naseh v'Nishma regarding all the laws, because they haven't learned the laws yet. But the Ramban is saying, again, what's the secret? The Ramban, it's in order. So we already had Parshat Mishpatim. So Rashi's going to tell us chapter 24 happened together with chapter 19 before chapter 20 and before chapters 21, 22, 23. So I'm going to ask you again, so what in the world brought Rashi to do this? As I told you, he loves the romantic Naseh v'Nishma. So he wants to save that Gemara, that the angel, you're so impetuous, how can you accept the Torah without knowing what it says? What are you talking about, knowing what it says? If you were to learn every single Mishnah and every single Gemara connected to Parshat Mishpatim, Rabbi, how much of a Shas would you cover? Yeah? You'd become a Dayan. If you were to learn every single Gemara, every Sugya, and every single part of the Shulchan Aruch, you'd get to, I'm telling you, large parts of Aruch Hayim, Yerodeah, Choshe Mishpat, Ebenezer, there's less of, but there's still some. You would do whole Masechtot, Baba Batra, Baba Kama, Baba Mitzir, whole Masechtot, you'd be learning. What? There's a little, there's very little. Yeah, very little. But the other areas, this whole areas of halacha that the people already learned at this point. And it's, yeah, Naseh v'Nishma. So according to the Ramban, Naseh v'Nishma is kind of ruined. But there's a more radical opinion than the Ramban. And that is the Chizkuni. And by the way, the three opinions, Rashi, Ramban, and the Chizkuni, they reflect, they're not identical. They reflect three opinions which are already found in the Mechilta. And the Mechilta is a second century source. So it's a much, much older source. But I don't want to confuse you completely. But I'll tell you what the Chizkuni says. At the very end of Sefer Vayikra, we have a part of the Torah which is called a tochacha. A tochacha is called sometimes a rebuke, a warning, and it says, if you don't follow these laws, this and this and this and this and this and this and this is going to happen to you. At the very end of the Tochacha it says, and this is the Torah, and this is the Mishpatim, and this is what was learned, this is what we received from God at Sinai. The Chizkuni says that the Sefer HaBrit, the covenant, or all of the curses and the threats in the Tochacha in Parshat Bichukotai, which means all at the end of Vayikra. He goes, no, that's what was read at that particular point, but the Torah doesn't tell us the whole thing until much, much later on. So now I have to try to explain this again. And I use the word romantic to explain Rashi. So now I want to use the idea of romance or getting married for all three opinions. Rashi is explaining essentially a Hasidic wedding where the Chatan and the Kala never met before. They have no idea what they're getting themselves into. And essentially, it's not a shotgun wedding, but a shadchan wedding, which is very, very close in terms of the idea. And it's a say, yeah, and if you want, I'm willing to say, yeah, completely romantic, but they have no idea what they're getting into. Naseh v'Nishma, total leap of faith, yes. Again, I'm sure my parents know what they're doing, and fine, this sounds wonderful. Could be, that's the solution for the shidduch crisis. I told my wife last night that the Shidduch crisis started with Gilligan's Island. Too many guys watched Gilligan's Island. They couldn't decide between Ginger and Marianne. That created all the problems in the world. They can't decide what they want in life. Those of you who have no idea what I'm talking about, all the better. It's good. You have to do homework. You have to go back and look and see what they're talking about. She didn't agree with me. So, according to the Ramban, they're under the chuppah, but you read the ketuvah, you understand what all your obligations are. According to what Rashi is saying, Naseh v'Nishma, I have no idea what my obligations are. According to the Ramban, I know exactly what my obligations are. According to the Chizkuni, you have a prenup. And the prenup is really a detailed prenup and say, if you mess up this relationship, you're going to have to pay this and this and this and this and this and this. Now you tell me which is most romantic. Because it's very easy to say that Rashi is more romantic. What? Could be that the Chizkuni is most romantic. You know exactly what you're getting into and you're doing it anyway. I think it could be. Say, I accept in myself every one of these conditions. Because the Chizkuni said that all of the curses in Mishnah Torah, in Torah Kohanim, at the end of Bechukotai, in Bechukotai, were read to them beforehand. So if they break the relationship with God, they're told, you're going to get cursed like this, you're going to get cursed like that, and they say, no, we accept it.
Do you know the details of the laws that they're getting, or they only know the repercussions for not following?
It would seem to be, according to Chizkuni, they know both. They know the Mishpatim, but now they also know what's the price if you don't follow these Mishpatim.
Does the Ramban think that they know?
No, because it's not in sequence. That's written afterwards. So I'm going to say it again. I can argue all three. I can argue that blind faith is something very romantic. I can argue that knowing exactly what my obligations are is romantic. I take it upon myself. Which means somebody who gets into something has no idea what they're getting themselves into. I don't know if we'd call it romantic or foolish. But the argument of the Chizkuni to say, no, I accept upon myself every single thing which is written over here. I think you have to start considering what that really means. I think that that's far more impressive than we're giving that credit for. Perhaps, again, we can argue. But what I'm really getting at is that there are three different ways of reading the Naseh V'Nishma. So what I was trying to get to today, when Rashi twists everything around and switches the whole sequence of everything, what did he end up doing? He saved Naseh V'Nishma. There's another issue that's going to come up because of all this, but I'll get to in a second. When the Ramban says, no, just read things in the proper order, Naseh V'Nishma is different. It's not the same as the Gemara. We know the Mishpatim already, but it's actually... See, for the Ramban, it's conversion. The Jews all converted just now to become Jews. Why? Because before Matan Torah, they weren't Jews. Now, how do you convert? Do you convert by saying Naseh V'Nishma? Or do you convert by saying, okay, what is exactly are my obligations? So according to the Ramban, in order to become a Jew, you need to know what you're accepting. So the Ramban sees Matan Torah as an act of conversion, and therefore every single Jew needs to know laws. You don't need to know every law, but you need to know what you're getting yourself into. And therefore Matan Torah, accepting the Torah, is one of an aspect of becoming Jewish, and therefore they need to know what they're getting themselves into. According to the Chizkuni, it's not just knowing what I get myself into, knowing what my obligations are, it's also knowing what are the repercussions of not keeping this. It's the repercussions. This is what happens if you don't keep this particular law. So the repercussions are what the Chizkuni says we accept as well. But I'm going to say it again. It's three different models of what Naseh V'Nishma mean. But let me go to this, flip over to the other side of this, because something else happens. The Nishma is always a problem for everybody. And by the way, I'll point out that in Sefer Dvarim, when we're told the whole thing again, then instead of saying Naseh V'Nishma, it's the other way around. It's Nishma V'Naseh in Sefer Dvarim. So also, it's quite interesting when Moshe repeats it. He apparently doesn't know the Gemara. But Naseh V'Nishma, Nishma is a problem, because Naseh sounds like it's moving forward. Nishma could be an ongoing listening. And the easy... Just one second. The easiest way of saying Nishma is that we accept. Mekabel. We're Mekabel. Yeah. Which is actually very consistent with the Targum throughout Sefer Devarim on what the word Shema means. Shema Yisrael, what does it mean? It doesn't mean listen. It's Lekabel. Naseh V'Nishma, we will accept. Naseh V'Nishma, we accept. It's actually the signing of the contract, making the Kinyan, we will absolutely be doing this. But there's a flip side to everything that I've been... We just said it, no? So, there's a flip side to all of this that we need to also pay attention to. And that is, what does Moshe do when he gets up there for 40 days and 40 nights? So, according to Rashi, he learns Parshat Mishpatim, which was already written. So, what does he learn? He's learning the Torah. But according to the Ramban, he already learned Parshat Mishpatim. So according to the Ramban, everything always follows the sequence. So according to the Ramban, what happens when he gets up in Shemayim? He starts learning about the building of the Mishkan. How do I know that? That's the next Pasuk. That's Parshat Trumah, Trumah Titzaveh. So according to the Ramban, what is Moshe learning up there? He gets the Seret Dibrot, he gets the tablets, but what is he learning with God? He's learning about how to make the how to make the Mishkan, which means essentially he's learning. If I had to look at that area, I'd call it Kodshim. He's learning about holiness. He's learning about something that we can do for God, as it were, which is really interesting, because according to Rashi, what he's doing when he's up there, he's learning Parshat Mishpatim, and he's learning about these other aspects of law. But according to Rashi, he's not learning about building the Mishkan, because Rashi says that the tziv, he says this at the very end of chapter Lamed Aleph, at the end of 31, he says that the tzivoy, the command for building the Mishkan, was only given after the Chet HaEgel. So according to Rashi, he didn't learn Parsha Truma and Tetzaveh when he's up in Shemayim. He's learning something else, because Rashi says he didn't learn that yet. There was no command yet given for this. So I'm just saying is, what is the nature of what's taking place in heaven becomes very, very different. I know the easy way to say this, he learned all of the Torah. I know that. I understand that. But I'm just saying, if you follow the Ramban, what is he learning right now? That's where Truma and Tetzaveh come in. If you're following Rashi, Truma and Tetzaveh are not introduced at this point. Obviously, other things are learning. So it's not just that when I raise this question of chronological integrity and Ein Mukdam Mukhar, it's not just a question of when things were told. It becomes powerful understanding of what things mean. It's not just how they're told, it's what things mean. And that's really, I think, what the message is that sometimes how you tell a story actually interprets the story as well. It's not just that you give little pieces of information along the way. It's putting things in context means something to us. And the example, therefore, that I gave you was Yitro versus Amalek. That becomes, according to Rashi, a really important teaching, because it's not the way that it happened, according to Rashi, but let's put them right next to one another, and now we had to ask ourselves, okay, what does that mean, that they're next to one another? And that's why, you know, we had that whole explanation in terms of, are non-Jews good or are they bad? And the answer is, well, that's far more complicated. People are people, and some are good and some are bad, and look at the way the Torah juxtaposed the two of them. But we only could have gotten to that when we understand that it was not the proper sequence. It's not just it happened to be told that way. No, quite the opposite. It's not that it happened to be told that way. It was deliberately told that way. So now, for what purpose? So every single time that things are going to change, we have to then start asking that. So I think part of what Rashi's trying to do is to save Na'aseh v'Nishma. I think that's part of the motivation over here, and to make it far more striking and far more accepting and so on. Yeah. I think so. Well, no, one second. You mean up in heaven?
Yeah.
I assume so.
Right.
So I assume that that's what he would say. Now, some people could take this a little bit too far and to say, which I think is too far, and say, oh, according to Rashi, had there never been a sin of the golden calf, there never would have been a Mishkan, because he says it was taught afterwards. Okay. It's possible that Rashi meant that. It's also possible he didn't mean that. Because just because Rashi tells us the sequence, it's also possible that that's what Rashi wants you not to think. Let me explain what I mean by that. That had things been written in the proper sequence, according to Rashi, that the Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf, is written, and then the instruction to build the Mishkan, then all of us would have come to the conclusion, oh, what's the Mishkan? It's somehow coming to fix the golden calf. By the way, I do want to say one thing about Rashi, about the Mishkan, and then we'll stop for today. Rashi says the word Mishkan comes from the word Mashkon. A Mashkon is a collateral. That he says that God told us to build the Mishkan just in case we mess up again and he gets mad at us, that he'll have something to break. Did you get what he just said? Is that if he gets mad at us, again, when we sin to the golden calf, God said, okay, I'll destroy the Jewish people. So he says, okay, afterwards, he says, okay, build a Mishkan. So we don't know, maybe we'll deal with this next week, we don't know right now, had there never been a golden calf, would there have been a Mishkan? We don't know that. It's easy to say, but I think that according to Rashi, it would end up being quite the opposite, that the Mishkan is presented before the golden calf in order that you not come to that conclusion, that had there not been a sin of the golden calf, there wouldn't be a Mishkan. That's why it's taught in this sequence where the Mishkan is presented before the sin of the golden calf. Don't conclude that had there not been. But according to Rashi, he says, what does the word Mishkan mean? He goes, one of the meanings could be Mashkon, which is, again, a collateral, that God is saying that if you mess up again, I'm not going to destroy you. By the way, that's part of the magic of Yom Kippur. That we are going to survive. Our souls are going to survive. The Jewish people are going to survive. So what happens if God gets mad at us? Mashkon, in order to keep the people around, and that's the Midrash, I'll take out my anger. Yes, the Brit will always remain, and I will take out my anger, al etz ve'evin. I will take out my anger on stuff. It's like somebody coming in and being mad at their kid. Okay, I'm taking your phone away. Why? Because I love you. But the kid will think, if you took the phone away, that means you don't love me anymore. No. No, because the relationship is before the mashkon. The mashkon is there that you didn't keep your word. Besedim, I'm going to take it out on some. Yeah. Yeah, but the relationship remains. Again, the relation, you didn't foreclose on your house, right? Yeah, and that's what he's saying. You still have the relationship stays, and I'll take it out on the mashkon, and that's why there was a. And that's what, yeah, look, and that's exactly the Midrash that I just now quoted. I'm sorry if I've lost you on this last point, is that when the Jews sinned and God is about to destroy the Beit HaMikdash, so if there was no Beit HaMikdash, he may have destroyed the Jews. So God says, no, I'll destroy the Beit HaMikdash, and the Jews survive. Which means we survived as a people long after we no longer have a Mishkan, long after we no longer have a Beit HaMikdash. God gets angry at us sometimes. We mess up sometimes. But it's always good to have... You know, let me say this differently. If God forbid something bad happened to us, our family, something, would you rather it be that God forbid somebody gets very sick or even God forbid dies, or that you have a setback financially? And don't say which relative right now so you can make an informed judgment. Right? No, if anything ever happens, you say, no, thank God it was only money. Thank God it was only possessions. Thank God it was only stuff. Thank God that we're still healthy. We never want this anger to be something which affects us directly. We always rather it be in some other way. Again, I think that this is obvious, but this is the way that Rashi fundamentally sees the Mishkan, as a way that God can take out his anger, which means it's like a phenomenal read of what a korban is. A korban is in order to fix, you know, the relationship with God. And Rashi is saying, we can't, not just the korban is to fix the relationship with God, the whole Mishkan is to fix the relationship with God. The whole Mishkan become a korban. And when God gets so angry with us, so then he takes the ultimate korban, he takes the ultimate sacrifice, and he sacrifices the Mishkan in order to save us. But again, the reason I'm going here, in case I lost you, the reason I'm going there is go back and ask these questions. Every time, according to Rashi, something's not in the proper sequence, why is it presented in this way? Or more importantly, what are the implications of it being presented in this way? What can I learn out of it being presented in this way? Because those ultimately become the issues that we need to deal with. So what did we do today? So we learned all of Sefer Shemot today. Everything after the Exodus, right? We learned all of Sefer Shemot post-Exodus. We went from chapter 15 to chapter 40. We got to most of them along the way. We dealt with issues of sequence. Again, most of us who did go to yeshiva, who were indoctrinated, we were indoctrinated in a Rashi world, and we see things in a certain way. The only problem is the Chumash is not presented in the way that Rashi tells us that things happen, which means I think that we need to print a new Chumash. One is everything that the sequence that we have, and then another Rashi Chumash. Put everything in the proper sequence according to Rashi and the order that everything took place. But if you really think about it, that's what I did for you today. And therefore, I gave... What? No. So, Chumash in the sequence. But that's what I did for you today. I try to show you each and every time there is this deviation, and we worked a little bit harder to try to understand why the deviation is. What can we learn from that deviation? What is the message that we end up getting from it? So I hope I didn't confuse you impossibly, and it really, everything should have made perfect sense today.